right now, like inside the walls of the hospital down the street, or you know that massive data center you drive past on the highway.
Oh yeah, the ones popping up everywhere.
Right, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Inside those walls, there isn't just this tangled mess of wires carrying the power.
Not anymore, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. There is a literal solid metal highway.
Which is pretty wild to think about.
It is. And because of the sheer heat and the, well, the raw electrical current it carries, that massive metal highway is physically expanding, moving, and like shifting inside the walls at this very moment.
It's basically a living, breathing system.
Yeah. And I mean, if you are anything like me, you probably just take electricity in these massive buildings totally for granted.
Oh, we all do. You flip a switch, the lights come on, you know.
Exactly. The servers hum, and you don't think twice. But the hidden mechanics of how you safely move, like thousands of amps of alternating current through a 100-story skyscraper, it's absolutely staggering.
It really is.
So today, our mission for this deep dive is to demystify exactly how that happens. We have got this stack of incredibly dense technical documents, engineering guides, manufacturer specs.
Lots of very dry reading.
So much dry reading. But we are going deep on a technology called busbar trunking systems, or BTS for short.
Right. And, you know, I get it. It does sound like a highly technical, maybe even intimidating engineering topic at first glance.
Oh, for sure. It sounds like jargon.
Yeah, but if we strip away all that jargon, this is really just a fascinating story about the evolution of building design.
How so?
Well, we are talking about a critical, necessary shift away from chaotic, permanent, point-to-point wiring toward a world of highly flexible, modular power distribution.
Right.
It is about how our infrastructure just had to adapt to a world that completely refuses to stand still.
Exactly. I love that. But before we can understand how this invisible river of power actually flows through a massive high-rise, we really have to understand what exactly is replacing those traditional bundles of copper wire.
Right. We kind of have to start with the foundational hardware.
Okay, let's unpack this. A busbar trunking system is defined in our sources as a prefabricated power distribution assembly.
Which is a very fancy way of saying a metal tube with conductors inside.
Yeah, pretty much. Its entire job is to transport bulk electrical energy, and it does this through a tested enclosure and conductor arrangement.
Right.
Think about traditional cable distribution for a second. Pulling traditional cable through a building is a lot like measuring and cutting, I don't know, custom lengths of yarn on site.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Right, because you have this massive spool,
yeah.
You physically pull it through conduits, you cut it, you strip it, you tie it off. It is incredibly manual and, honestly, really messy.
And highly dependent on the skill of the person doing it that exact day.
Yeah, exactly. A busbar trunking system, on the other hand, is basically high-tech Lego blocks for electricity.
Lego blocks, yeah.
You have these rigid, modular, prefabricated straight lengths. You've got elbows. You've got joints. You literally just snap them together to build your power route.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, that modular, prefabricated nature is exactly why this technology matters so much to modern electrical engineers.
Because it takes out the guesswork.
Precisely. Because these systems are factory engineered, and specifically they sit within the international IEC 61439 family of standards, their performance is incredibly predictable.
Right. They follow a strict rule book.
Right. I mean, think about it. When you bundle a bunch of thick side-assembled cables together, the electrical performance can be highly variable based on how the installation crew happened to route them that day.
Like, are they pinched in a corner? Are they too close together?
Exactly. Did someone pull it a bit too tight?
Yeah.
But with a bus bar trunking system, the enclosure, the joints, the insulation, all of it, it is all verified in a pristine factory environment.
And the sources mentioned that this factory verification covers things like dielectric-related performance. Now, for those of us who aren't electrical engineers, what exactly does that mean?
Dielectric performance. It basically refers to the strength of the insulation. When you have thousands of volts of electricity running through a massive metal bar, that electricity desperately wants to jump to the nearest ground or, you know, to the bar right next to it.
Like a lightning strike looking for a path.
Exactly like that. The dielectric strength is how well the insulating material prevents that electricity from escaping under massive stress.
Oh, I see.
In a factory, they can test that insulation to absolute extremes, ensuring it won't break down. It is fundamentally more repeatable than just hoping a guy with a roll of electrical tape did a perfect job in a dusty basement.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
It takes that human guesswork completely out of the equation.
Yeah.
But of course, reading through these procurement guides, there's this massive debate that engineering teams face, which is flexibility versus first cost.
Always. It always comes down to the budget, right?
Right.
Cables can absolutely remain the most economical choice for short, simple routes where you just don't anticipate any future changes. But the bus bar trunking system packs significantly more current into a much smaller physical space. It installs way faster. And crucially, it offers a vastly cleaner modification path.
Because of the Legos.
Right. You are trading a higher initial purchase price up front for the ability to safely adapt the system later without literally tearing open the drywall to pull new wire.
Right. And because these systems rely on those factory engineered physical blocks rather than flexible wire, the specific materials and the internal architecture of those Lego blocks basically entirely dictate how much power they can handle.
Which brings us to the actual physical construction inside those metal enclosures.
Right. Our sources separate the main construction types into two heavy hitters.
Right.
We've got sandwich construction, which they also call a compact stack, versus air-insulated construction.
Yeah, the two main flavors.
Now, wait. This didn't make sense to me when I read it. Air is totally free, and it's a notoriously good insulator.
It is.
So why on earth would you spend money to squeeze live, high-voltage conductors together into a tight little sandwich? Doesn't that just invite a short circuit?
You know, it is a totally logical question. It really seems counterintuitive at first.
Right.
But it comes down to the bizarre physics of moving massive amounts of alternating current.
Okay.
What's fascinating here is how alternating current behaves. When AC flows through a conductor, it generates a magnetic field.
Okay, I'm with you.
If you have your separate phase conductors spaced far apart like you would in an air-insulated system, those magnetic fields actually fight each other. They create something called reactance.
So the electricity is basically fighting its own flow.
Exactly. Reactance acts a lot like resistance. It chunks the flow of the current.
Oh, wow.
But if you take those conductors, wrap them in that high-strength dielectric insulation we talked about, and laminate them together into a super tight, compact sandwich.
Wait, let me guess. The magnetic field cancel out.
Precisely. Their magnetic fields effectively cancel each other out. By reducing that reactance, the sandwich design allows you to push an incredibly high current density through a very small space.
Oh, wow. So you are essentially hacking the magnetic fields to pack a massive punch into a tiny footprint.
Exactly. You're using physics to your advantage. The sources cite the Siemens LI system as a perfect example of this.
Right, I saw that.
That sandwich system handles anywhere from 800 amps up to an astonishing 6,300 amps, and it's heavily used in these massive multi-story buildings.
That is a crazy amount of power.
It is.
Yeah.
Now, when you compare that to air-insulated busbar trunking, where the conductors are indeed separated by air gaps within the housing, the air option is still great for lower-density routes.
Yeah.
But it takes up a significantly larger physical footprint, and because of that reactance we talked about, it often offers lower performance during short circuits.
Okay, so a tight sandwich for high-density, high-power situations, and air-insulated for lighter duty where you actually have the physical room in the building to spare.
Right.
But there's another massive debate hiding inside these enclosures, and you could probably start a literal fight in any engineering break room by bringing it up.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Copper versus aluminum.
Ah, yes. The great conductor debate.
Copper obviously offers higher conductivity, right?
Yeah.
You can use a smaller piece of metal to move the exact same amount of power.
Yes, that's true.
But aluminum is so much lighter. I mean, if you were running a power line up a 60-story building, aluminum drastically reduces the overall mass and, honestly, the raw material cost.
It really does. But choosing aluminum isn't just a free pass to save money on your building.
No.
No, it comes with incredibly strict engineering caveats. Because of how aluminum behaves chemically, it is highly reactive to oxygen.
Okay.
When bare aluminum is exposed to air, it instantly forms an invisible oxide layer on its surface.
Like it's instantly rusting, basically.
Exactly just that. And that invisible oxide layer acts like a microscopic wall, completely resisting the flow of electricity.
Oh, that sounds bad.
It is. If you don't properly treat an aluminum joint, that resistance turns into heat. And heat, in a high voltage system, means fire.
Right.
So the joints require highly specific surface treatments, often tin or silver plating, and specialized connector designs. You have to maintain incredibly strict antioxidation practices at every single connection point to ensure that microscopic wall just doesn't form.
Wow. Okay, so you can have a perfectly machined copper sandwich or a perfectly treated aluminum air gap system. But that just tells us about the capacity, right?
Right.
It doesn't actually explain how the electricity gets from the main transformer down in the basement all the way up to a specific server rack on, like, the 40th floor.
No, for that, we need to map how the route is actively managed.
Okay, well, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the system splits into two entirely different functional runs. We have feeder runs and plug-in runs.
Right. And sometimes those plug-ins are called rising mains if they go vertical up a building shaft.
Got it. So if we use a highway analogy, think of a feeder run like an express highway. It is designed to move power point to point, from the source to a downstream electrical board. Zero exits, zero tap-offs.
Just straight through.
Just straight through. And because there are no interruptions, the design heavily emphasizes low impedance and massive fault-withstand capabilities.
And we should definitely clarify what those terms mean in the real world.
Yeah, please do.
Low impedance simply means the path of absolute least resistance. It brute forces the power from point A to point B as efficiently as physically possible.
Okay.
And fault withstand capability is crucial. If there is a massive short circuit somewhere in the building, the sudden surge of energy creates violent magnetic forces.
Like how violent?
Violent enough that they will literally try to rip the metal bars apart. A feeder run is built like a tank to physically survive that explosion of magnetic force.
Wow. So it's just a pure armored power hose.
Yes, exactly.
But the plug-in runs, those are your local roads. They have exits built right in. These are tap-off interfaces placed all along the metal enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what allows power to be distributed floor by floor in a high-rise residential building or a hospital. You can just plug a box right into the local road without having to pull a brand new cable all the way from the basement every single time you need power on a new floor.
And this is exactly where that modular Lego concept we talked about really proves its worth.
The actual anatomy of these routes is wild when you look at the catalogs. You don't just buy a long metal stick.
No, not at all.
You have straight length units carrying the bulk current. You have elbows and bend units changing directions at 90 degrees to, you know, go around the concrete pillar.
Right.
You have T-junctions splitting the run. And honestly, my absolute favorite detail from the sources, expansion joints.
Oh, yes. The expansion joints are critical engineering.
Because it is a great reminder that these massive structures we build aren't static.
Exactly. They move.
Think of a bridge in the summer, right?
Right.
It has those interlocking metal teeth so the concrete can swell in the heat without cracking. These metal bars inside the walls are doing the exact same thing. Thermal expansion means the copper or aluminum is literally growing and shrinking as it heats up from the current.
And the buildings themselves are settling and swaying in the wind.
Right, so the expansion joints compensate for all that longitudinal movement so the continuous power route doesn't literally tear itself out of the ceiling.
It really is a dynamic system. And while the structural components are fascinating from an engineering perspective, the safety components are absolutely non-negotiable.
Tell me about those.
Two critical pieces of the anatomy stand out here. You have the ground bus bar and the fire barriers.
Okay.
The ground bus bar maintains a continuous earthing path along the entire run. If there is a short, that raw energy needs an immediate safe path back to the source to trip the breaker.
Otherwise, you know, bad things happen.
Very bad things. And then you have the fire barriers.
Right, because if you punch a giant hole through a concrete floor to run your power line up to the next level, you basically just created a chimney. You just completely destroyed the building's fire rating.
You did. And the fire barriers are what maintain the fire compartment integrity of the building. And the sources are very clear on this. Procurement teams need to compare the complete assembly.
Right.
A supposedly cheaper trunking run becomes incredibly dangerous and ultimately vastly more expensive if the necessary support hardware or tested fire stop accessories are missing.
Which makes you realize, like, you can have the most perfectly engineered, factory-tested copper sandwich in the entire world.
Yeah.
But if the guy installing it on the 40th floor forgets a fire stop or messes up the joint coating, the whole thing is completely compromised.
Exactly.
And that brings us directly out of the theoretical design phase and into the harsh reality of real-world installation. And let me tell you, reading these documents, The laws governing these installations are incredibly strict.
As they absolutely should be, considering the energy levels we are talking about here. I mean, we are talking about the rule books that keep skyscrapers from burning down.
Yeah, no pressure.
Right. You don't just build these however you want. In the international market, the governing rule book is IEC 614396, which replaced the older IEC 60439-2.
Right, the new standard.
Exactly. It legally defines the service conditions, the construction rules, and the verification requirements for systems up to 1,000 volts AC.
Okay.
Meanwhile, in North American markets, you are playing by an entirely different rule book, specifically UL 857. And the sources explicitly state that IEC versus UL isn't just a polite naming difference.
It's not just a translation thing.
No, it is a fundamental compliance and legal distinction.
You really have to know whose rules you are playing by. And it's not just about the electricity itself, right? It is about the physical environment surrounding the electricity.
Yes.
You don't just buy a bus bar system. You buy it for a specific room. Which brings us to the IP ratings, the environmental protection codes.
Yes.
Our sources lay out a really great table for this. If you are in a dry indoor environment like a standard commercial office building, you might only need an IP31 rating.
Right. Pretty basic protection.
But if you are in an industrial indoor space, like, say, a manufacturing plant with dust flying everywhere, you step up to IP54.
Just to protect against that dust and random splashing.
Right. Then, for outdoor external risers, you need IP65. And it goes all the way up to IP66 for extreme wet hose-down areas.
Yeah, that's intense.
They specifically mention breweries and chemical processing in the text. Just picture that for a second. You have thousands of amps of electricity running through a room where a guy is literally spraying the walls down with a high-pressure water hose.
It sounds like a disaster waiting to happen.
That sounds absolutely terrifying.
It is terrifying if it's not engineered correctly. That's why an IP66 rating isn't a suggestion. The system has to preserve its absolute ceiling across every single joint, every tap off, and every end cap.
Wow. Okay, well, this raises an important question. How do engineers actually size these systems so they don't just fail in those environments?
The crucial insight here is regarding thermal rating and day rating factors. When you put a metal box carrying current inside a hot room, it can't carry as much power safely.
Because it's already hot.
Exactly. The sources heavily emphasize that designers cannot just copy generic mathematical rules used for standard cables and apply them to a bus bar. It completely fails.
Oh, wow.
They must use manufacturer-specific thermal rating data. For example, the sources mention ABB publishing highly detailed D-rating data for their systems.
So they have to do custom maths for every setup.
Pretty much. An engineer has to factor in the ambient temperature of the specific room, the physical mounting orientation, like, is the bar lying flat or is it on its edge acting like a heat sink?
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
Right. And they even have to calculate how closely grouped multiple systems are to each other.
Okay, so the engineering software calculates all the thermal DIR rating, the manufacturer builds the Lego blocks in a pristine factory, and it arrives on site. Does the installation crew just snap them together and go home early?
Absolutely not. Not even close. In fact, installation quality has a direct, profound effect on whether the system complies with safety standards at all.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Support brackets, for instance, must be meticulously placed, generally every 1.5 to 3 meters. You cannot just let thousands of pounds of copper hang out in midair.
Yeah. Gravity always wins.
Always. Furthermore, snapping the joints together requires highly specific torque settings.
Like tightening a bolt on a car engine.
Exactly. If you don't tighten the bolts enough, you get resistance and fire. If you tighten them too much, you strip the threading and ruin the connection.
Wow.
The installers have to ensure perfect alignment before energization. They absolutely cannot mix untested parts from different manufacturers. Doing so instantly voids the IP rating, the fire integrity, and the fault performance.
It just ruins everything.
Yep. The scrutiny is so high that BSI publishes dedicated assessment methods specifically for cast resin busbar trunking used on life safety supplies. There is zero room for improvisation on site.
No improvising. You follow the sequence exactly. So because these systems require such rigorous upfront design, specialized software, and completely pristine by-the-book installation, where is all this intense effort actually worth the investment?
Well, it comes down to identifying the environments where a traditional cable simply cannot keep up with the demands of the facility.
Right, the ultimate use cases. The sources point to a few key environments where bus bar trunking just shines.
Data centers are a massive one.
Oh, yeah. Because you have incredibly dense racks of servers, And the power map is constantly changing as old servers are ripped out and new ones are brought in.
Exactly. That environment heavily favors those plug-in runs we talked about, with fast local exits.
The text specifically references Schneider positioning their Canalys system for this exact high-density, scalable distribution.
It's perfect for that. High-rise shafts are another one, replacing unmanageable bundles of heavy feeder cable.
Right. And factories, where heavy CNC machines constantly need to be moved to reconfigure assembly lines.
And we shouldn't overlook the renewable energy sector either.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you brought that up. The sources drop this fascinating detail about Victron-style busbar configurations.
Yeah.
They are highly utilized for direct current, or DC distribution, in renewable setups, like interfacing with heavy solar battery banks.
Which is becoming more and more common.
So what does this all mean? When we put the busbar trunking system head-to-head against traditional cable in the final showdown,
yeah.
What is the actual takeaway for someone designing a massive building today?
Well, the synthesis of all these sources is that the debate is not just some marketing slogan. It is a fundamental life cycle economic decision.
Okay.
It is true that traditional cables might present a lower upfront material cost, but busbar trunking wins decisively on long-term maintainability.
Because it's adaptable.
Exactly. If you are building a facility where you know you're going to change your floor layouts or constantly upgrade dense server racks or move heavy factory equipment around over the next 20 years, the higher upfront cost of a modular busbar system is completely dwarfed by the massive savings in labor and electrical flexibility over the life of that building.
It's the difference between literally tearing down drywall every single time you need a new massive power outlet versus just walking up and plugging into the existing power highway.
Exactly. You are optimizing for long-term agility.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap up this deep dive, let's look at what we've unpacked here today. The invisible power highways running through the walls of our most advanced modern buildings are not just messy bundles of wire.
Not anymore.
They are highly engineered modular systems. Whether it's a compact copper sandwich using canceled magnetic fields to move massive power up a skyscraper, or an IP66-rated aluminum system surviving a high-pressure washdown in a brewery, these trunking systems are meticulously designed for a world that refuses to stand still.
They really are.
And you now know the difference between the express lane feeders and the local road plug-ins, and exactly why slapping generic cable math onto a busbar design is an absolute recipe for disaster.
Yeah, please don't do that. And, you know, as we close, there is one more critical layer to this that is absolutely worth your time to explore on your own.
Oh, what's that?
We've spent this entire deep dive talking about how these physical metal pathways are constructed, tested, and sized to safely deliver current to a machine.
Right.
But moving the electricity physically from point A to point B is only half the battle. If you really want to understand efficient power distribution, your next rabbit hole should be exploring something called power factor.
Power factor? I haven't heard of that.
Yes. Think of it like a glass of beer.
Okay, I'm listening.
The liquid beer is the actual working power your machine uses.
Got it.
The foam on top, that's wasted capacity. It takes up space in the glass, but it doesn't do any actual work.
Oh, wow.
Power factor is the ratio of the liquid to the foam. You can build the most beautiful, heavily engineered copper busbar highway in the world, but if the machines at the end of the line are drawing mostly foam, your entire system is incredibly inefficient.
That's crazy.
Yeah. How efficiently the power is actually utilized by the load changes everything about how you design the system.
Oh, that is a brilliant way to look at it. The journey doesn't just end when the power drops off the busbar. It's about how the machine actually swallows the energy. I love it.
Exactly.
Well, we went from imagining pulling raw yarn across a dusty construction site to snapping together a highly engineered, factory-tested Lego set of sheer power. It completely changes how you look at the ceiling of a hospital or a data center. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive, and we will catch you on the next one.